Afternoon, everybody. Now, the sutta today, I don't know if you already know what the sutta is, if the news has got out. Well, it's called the Dhatu Vibhanga Sutta, the Exposition of the Elements. That's Sutta 140 in the Majjhima Nikaya. Okay, so this is a very interesting sutta. It might be a little heavy going of some people. If some people are new to the teaching, they might find it maybe a little strange or a little abstract. And that's because it's dealing in part with some of the mostly with the later stages of the practice. And it's a very interesting setting, this. What the scene is, that the Buddha is on tour, wandering by himself in the Magadan country, and for the night he gets a place to stay in a potter's workshop. And in this potter's workshop, there's another monk. Well, it seems that he's not a full monk. He's just newly gone forth, and he seems to be a novice. But he has gone forth in the discipline of the Buddha. He's been ordained by someone in some sort of outlying district because he's taken an interest in the Buddha's teaching, but he's never met the Buddha. He doesn't know who the Buddha is, and so it's very interesting the way the whole scene starts. This other monk or novice, he's actually also staying in this potter's shed, and so the Buddha comes in and asks if it's okay if he can share the night in this potter's shed with this monk. And this monk says, yes, fine, plenty of room here. You can share, he calls him friend, just like another monk. He doesn't know who he is. Yes, friend, come in, you're welcome, there's plenty of space here. You can share this scene with me. And of course, the exciting thing underlying the whole story is that then they get involved in conversation. And he doesn't know. He doesn't know it's actually the Buddha that he's talking and conversing with. So it has this very sort of intriguing underlying sense of drama that's going on underneath all the time. Anyway, so I'll get into it. Thus have I heard on one occasion. The Blessed One was wandering in the Magadan country and eventually arrived at Rajagaha. There he went to the potter, Bhagava, and said to him, "If it is not inconvenient for you, Bhagava, I will stay one night in your workshop. It is not inconvenient for me, Venerable Sir, but there is a homeless one already staying there. If he agrees, then stay as long as you like, Venerable Sir." Now, there was a clansman named Pukusati who had gone forth from the home life into homelessness out of faith in the Blessed One. And on that occasion, he was already staying in the potter's workshop. Then the Blessed One went to the Venerable Pukusati and said to him, "If it is not inconvenient for you, Bhikkhu, I will stay one night in the workshop. The potter's workshop is large enough, friend. Let the Venerable One stay as long as he likes." Then the Blessed One entered the potter's workshop, prepared a spread of grass at one end and sat down, folding his legs crosswise, setting his body erect and establishing mindfulness in front of him. Then the Blessed One spent most of the night seated in meditation. And the Venerable Pukusati also spent most of the night seated in meditation. Then the Blessed One thought, this clansman's conduct, this clansman conducts himself in a way that inspires confidence. Suppose I were to question him. So he asked the Venerable Pukkasati, "Under whom have you gone forth, Bhikkhu? Who is your teacher? Whose Dharma do you profess? Friend, there is a recluse, Gotama, the son of the Sakyans, who went forth from the Sakyan clan. Now, a good report of that blessed Gotama has been spread to this effect. That blessed one is accomplished, fully enlightened, perfect in true knowledge and conduct, sublime knower of the worlds, incomparable leader of persons to be tamed, teacher of gods and humans, enlightened, blessed. I have gone forth under that blessed one. That blessed one is my teacher. I profess the Dharma of that blessed one." "But, Bhikkhu, where is that blessed one, accomplished and fully enlightened, now living?" "There is, friend, a city in the northern country named Sarvati. The blessed one, accomplished and fully enlightened, is now living there." "But, Bhikkhu, have you ever seen this blessed one before? Would you recognize him if you saw him?" "No, friend, I have never seen that blessed one before, nor would I recognize him if I saw him." Then the blessed one thought, "This clansman has gone forth from the home life into homelessness under me. Suppose I were to teach him the Dharma." So the blessed one addressed the Venerable Pukkasati thus, "Bhikkhu, I will teach you the Dharma. Listen and attend closely to what I say." "Yes, friend," said the Venerable Pukkasati. The blessed one said this, "Bhikkhu, this person consists of six elements, six bases of contact, and 18 kinds of mental exploration. And he has four foundations. The tides of conceiving do not sweep over one who stands upon these foundations. And when the tides of conceiving no longer sweep over him, he is called a sage at peace. One should not neglect wisdom, should preserve truth, should cultivate relinquishment, and should train for peace. This is the summary of the exposition of the six elements." Now that's a bit of a mouthful. I think I'd just like to go over that again a bit, because that's basically all those headings, all those titles, that's what the sutta's about. The Buddha puts all these in order. It shows how they all support each other. And this is actually an expression, sort of an indication or a definition of what the teaching of the Buddha is about. So I'll go over them again, and then you can pay attention to each individual title, but don't get too intimidated by them, because the Buddha then goes into each one in detail and then explains what they are. So I'll just go through. This person consists of six elements, six bases of contact, the 18 kinds of mental exploration, and he has four foundations. This expression here, four foundations, that isn't a reference to the four foundations of mindfulness in this case. It's something else that's being referred to. The tides of conceiving do not sweep over the one who stands upon these foundations. See, that's a lovely expression, that the tides of conceiving do not sweep over one who stands upon these foundations. And when the tides of conceiving no longer sweep over him, he is called a sage at peace. One should not neglect wisdom, should preserve truth, should cultivate relinquishment, and should train for peace. This is the summary of the exposition of the six elements. Bhikkhu, This person consists of six elements, so it was said. And with reference to what was this said? There are the earth element, the water element, the fire element, the air element, the space element, and the consciousness element. So apart from what we normally call the four great elements, that's earth, water, fire, and air, there are two more included here. That's the space element and the consciousness element. So it was with reference to this that it was said, Bhikkhu, this person consists of six elements. Bhikkhu, this person consists of six bases of contact. So it was said. And with reference to what was this said? There are the base of eye contact, the base of ear contact, the base of nose contact, the base of tongue contact, the base of body contact, the base of mind contact. So it was with reference to this that it was said, Bhikkhu, this person consists of six bases of contact. Bhikkhu, this person consists of 18 kinds of mental exploration, so it was said. And with reference to what was this said? On seeing a form with the eye, one explores that form, productive of joy. One explores that form, productive of grief. One explores that form, productive of equanimity. On hearing a sound with the ear, smelling an odor with the nose, tasting a flavor with the tongue, touching a tangible with the body, cognizing a mind object with the mind, one explores a mind object productive of joy, one explores a mind object productive of grief, one explores a mind object productive of equanimity. So it was with reference to this that it was said, Bhikkhu, this person consists of 18 kinds of mental exploration. What basically there, what's all that is being said is that with the six senses, there is experience of joy, experience of grief, and experience of equanimity. So basically what this means is it's the feeling of pleasantness, the feeling of unpleasantness, and neutral experience. So it's basically those three conscious experiences with the six senses. So that's the 18 altogether. Bhikkhu, this person has four foundations, so it was said. And with reference to what was this said, that there are the foundation of wisdom, the foundation of truth, the foundation of relinquishment, and the foundation of peace. So quite simply, foundation of wisdom here is like a reference to basically the satipatthana, mindfulness, just being aware. Basically, vipassana training, being consciously attentive to whatever arises at any point, at any time. That's the wisdom faculty. The foundation of truth, that's like the sila, the discipline. That's being truthful in your speech, being truthful in all your conduct. Basically, the ethical side of one's practice and life. The foundation of relinquishment, that's a reference to restraint. Generally, and the same thing in the sila and ethics, just restraint in your behavior, in the way you conduct yourself. In other words, the precepts, being with the precepts. And of course, with a monk, that would refer to the Patimokkha discipline. The foundation of peace here refers to the pacifying of the mental defilements. So it's all in the same vein, basically. Your practice in life and in your day-to-day activities of just sort of containing the defilements that arise and working and dealing with defilements so that you're pacifying them, so that basically you're having a peaceful time. You're not suffering from the agitation that comes from allowing the defilements to rule your life. Okay. One should not neglect wisdom, should preserve truth, should cultivate relinquishment, and should train for peace. So it was said, and with reference to what was this said? How, bhikkhu, does one not neglect wisdom? There are the six elements: the earth element, the water element, the fire element, the air element, the space element, and the consciousness element. What, bhikkhu, is the earth element? The earth element may be either internal or external. What is the internal earth element? Whatever internally belonging to oneself is solid, solidified, and clung to. This is the operative word here. Is clung to. It's not just the element of earth, not just the flesh and the bones, but the fact that this is clung to. You know, it's the attachment to the body here, and this makes the big difference. It's like with the khandhas, the five khandhas of attachment. It is this attachment, the fact that they're clung to, which make them such a problem for a person. That is, head hairs, body hairs, nail, teeth, skin, flesh, sinews, bones, bone marrow, kidneys, heart, liver, diaphragm, spleen, lungs, large intestines, small intestines, contents of the stomach, feces, or whatever else internally belonging to oneself is solid, solidified, and clung to. This is called the internal earth element. Now, both the internal earth element and the external earth element are simply earth element. And that should be seen as it actually is with proper wisdom. Thus, this is not mine. This I am not. This is not myself. When one sees it thus, as it actually is with proper wisdom, one becomes disenchanted with the earth element and makes the mind dispassionate towards the earth element. What, bhikkhu, is the water element? And this body that normally that is so important to us that we attach to, we have a great fondness for, the bhikkhu here goes into the water element, and absolutely no sentimentality whatsoever, just, you know, gives it to you straight. You know, you're attaching to these things, you're clinging to these things, but, you know, you know, then, but are they really yours? What, bhikkhus, is the water element? The water element may be either internal or external. What is the internal water element? Whatever internally belonging to oneself is water, watery, and clung to, that is bile, phlegm, pus, blood, sweat, fat, tears, grease, spittle, snot, oil of the joints, urine, or whatever else internally belonging to oneself is water, watery, and clung to. This is called the internal water element. Now, you might think to yourself, all those nasty things, do you really identify with them? Do you really consider that that's yourself? Do you really find any great difficulty in letting go of them and not identify with them? Well, you just think of some of those things when you consider them as being yours, and other people seeing them, you know, like even if it's feces and urine and things. Now, when they're yours, you know, you might think, so if I don't attach these, I'm letting them go. But do you want other people to see them? You know, how do you feel, you know, if these things, you know, were open view to other people, you know? Suddenly, wouldn't you identify with them and feel sort of very sort of self-conscious and concerned? You know, then you see, you know, you're identifying that, even if it's excrement, you're identifying that as me, you know, and you're in actual fact, you're clinging to it, you know. But of course, it's just the earth element, it's the water element, the same as all the other earth and water elements in the world, and it's just passing through you, and it isn't really you. You know, because you can't own it. It's leaving you all the time. It comes and it goes. But of course, we identify with this as my body, and it's very meaningful to us. Now, both the internal water element and the external water element are simply water element, and that should be seen as it actually is with proper wisdom. Thus, this is not mine. This I am not. This is not myself. When one sees it thus, as it actually is with proper wisdom, one becomes disenchanted with the water element and makes the mind dispassionate towards the water element. What, bhikkhu, is the fire element? The fire element may be either internal or external. What is the internal fire element? Whatever internally belonging to oneself is fire, fiery and clung to, that is, that by which one is warmed, ages, and is consumed, and that by which what is eaten, drunk, consumed, and tasted gets completely digested. It's interesting that, you know, even in the time of the Buddha, it was understood that digestion and the aging process, these all came about actually by heat. Like, we know this, and that wasn't completely obvious to me, I must say, until I read it on occasion, that when we digest things and we are actually getting older, it's a burning away process. When digestion is actually a process that occurs because of actually burning, and it's obviously apparent to the Buddha in those days. Now, both the internal fire element and the external fire element are simply fire element. And that should be seen as it actually is with proper wisdom thus. This is not mine. This I am not. This is not myself. When one sees it thus, as it actually is with proper wisdom, one becomes disenchanted with the fire element and makes the mind dispassionate towards that fire element. What bhikkhu is the air element? The air element may be either internal or external. What is the internal air element? Whatever internally belonging to oneself is air, airy, and clung to, that is, upgoing winds, downgoing winds, winds in the belly, winds in the bowels, winds that course through the limbs, in-breaths and out-breaths, or whatever else internally belonging to oneself is air, airy, and clung to, this is called the internal air element. Now, both the internal air element and the external air element are simply air element. And that should be seen as it actually is with proper wisdom thus. This is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself.
So that's something maybe that we can relate to a little bit more easier. The air element in the wind air element in the body, because there is this continual sort of reciprocal relationship we have with breathing. When we take an in breath, it's quite clear that in breath is coming outside from outside, and then almost instantaneously we breathe out again, and that wind element, that air, goes back into the outside world. So in this way, we can begin to get some a little bit of an idea of what the Buddha is saying here. Things like that, the air and the wind, we don't really identify these things so much as us. When we breathe in, we don't think in terms of this is my air, this is my wind element. You can see the Buddha is applying this, of course, to the whole of the body. Now, the whole of the body is something which is some of the time internally inside us and makes us and which we are, and then some of the time those same elements are outside of us and not connected with us at all. It's the idea that the benefit of using the breath is that when you breathe in, there's less tendency to think that this, you know, my lungs are expanded with air at the moment. You don't tend to think that this air is me, you know, this is my air and this is part of my body, because almost instantly you breathe that out again, right? And so you do feel that it is something that you are borrowing, in a sense, from the outside world, you know, to keep you going. Very handy stuff. But there's less tendency to identify with it as you, as your body, whereas, like, the flesh and the bones, it stays around a bit longer and gives, you know, and then you have a chance to become attached to it, and you really do believe that is you. But it's no more you, you know, than the air that you're breathing in. So, you know, the interesting thing here is you can actually use the breath to see that, you know, this is not me, this is not mine, this is not myself. It is, you know, it's making me for an instant, but then, you know, I dissolve once it's gone. You know, if you didn't breathe in again after once you breathed out and you never breathed in again, then you would sort of dissolve very quickly as a result of that. Then this thing that you think is you and permanent, now then you would soon see that this permanence is dissolving very quickly. When one sees it thus, as it actually is with proper wisdom, one becomes disenchanted with the air element and makes the mind dispassionate towards the air element. What, bhikkhu, is the space element? The space element may be either internal or external. What is the internal space element? Whatever internally belongs to oneself is space, spatial, and clung to. That is, the holes in the ears, the holes in the nostrils, the door of the mouth, and that aperture whereby what is eaten, drunk, consumed, and tasted gets swallowed, and where it collects, and whereby it is excreted from below. So that's, you know, that's quite an interesting imagery there, you know, that when he says and tasted gets swallowed and where it collects. So obviously the reference here is to the stomach, that space aperture of the stomach. You know, when the stomach is empty, that is the space aperture. But we can see that, you know, how do we really relate to that space in the empty stomach as my space, you know? Because, you know, then we put food into it, then we can see very quickly when we get full up, that space, whether we clung to it or not, we thought it was my space, you know, when it's filled with food, then that space disappears, you know, but then of course it empties again. But we just tend to think of my stomach, you know, which we tend to think generally is some sort of balloon-like thing with the space area inside it. Okay, and whereby it is excreted from below, and whatever else internally belonging to oneself is space, spatial, and clung to. This is called the internal space element. Now, both the internal space element and the external space element are simply space element, and that should be seen as it actually is with proper wisdom. Thus, this is not mine, this I am not, this is not myself. When one sees it thus, as it actually is with proper wisdom, one becomes disenchanted with the space element
and makes the mind dispassionate towards the space element. Then there remains only consciousness, purified and bright. What does one cognize with that consciousness? One cognizes this is pleasant. One cognizes this is painful. One cognizes this is neither painful nor pleasant. In dependence on a contact to be felt as pleasant, there arises pleasant feeling. When one feels a pleasant feeling, one understands, I feel a pleasant feeling. One understands, with the cessation of that same contact to be felt as pleasant, its corresponding feeling, the pleasant feeling that arose in dependence on that contact to be felt as pleasant, ceases and subsides. In dependence on a contact to be felt as painful, there arises a painful feeling. When one feels a painful feeling, one understands, I feel a painful feeling. One understands, with the cessation of that same contact to be felt as painful, its corresponding feeling, the painful feeling that arose in dependence on that contact to be felt as painful, ceases and subsides. In dependence on a contact to be felt as neither painful nor pleasant, there arises a neither painful nor pleasant feeling. When one feels that neither painful or pleasant feeling, one understands, I feel a neither painful or pleasant feeling. One understands, with the cessation of that same contact, the neither painful or pleasant feeling that arose in dependence on that contact to be felt ceases and subsides. In other words, what's being said here is the Buddha is indicating that this whole process of feeling and cognizing is very much dependent on conditionality, you know, cause and effect. When something touches the body, which causes pleasantness, that contact. Then pleasantness arises, and that pleasantness is only there as long as that contact with whatever it is that causes a pleasant feeling remains in place. But the moment that contact is gone, then that pleasant feeling disappears. And the same with painful feeling, same with neutral feeling. It just purely and simply that it is. It all depends completely on whether there is contact present or not. Bhikkhu, just as from the contact and friction of two fire sticks, heat is generated and fire is produced, and with the separation and disjunction of these two fire sticks, the corresponding heat ceases and subsides. So too, in dependence on a contact to be felt as pleasant, to be felt as painful, to be felt as neither painful nor pleasant, there arises a neither painful nor pleasant feeling, and so on and so forth. One understands, with the cessation of that same contact to be felt as neither painful nor pleasant, its corresponding feeling ceases and subsides. Then there remains only equanimity, purified and bright, malleable, wieldy, and radiant. Now this is an interesting sentence here. Then there remains only equanimity. So the Buddha is talking now of this conscious quality of equanimity. So it's very rarely that you get such a definition of equanimity. Normally, the impression is that it's an evenness of consciousness. Or sometimes it's referred to as a neutralness, neither this, neither that, not too much of this, not too much of that, and a certain evenness about it. But here, the Buddha gives it very definite, tangible qualities. There remains only equanimity, purified and bright, malleable, in the sense that
it's like it's something that is a very effective thing to be used, malleable in the sense that you can mold it as if it were like clay or putty. It's something that you can actually construct with. You can make something out of it. It's a quality where you can get a very definite effect by using it in a certain way. Sorry? Well, the Buddha will eventually. But malleable means that this quality of the mind is something. Now, what the Buddha is saying here now is that the mind. Yes, talking about equanimity now. The quality of equanimity in the mind here is that it is now something which isn't just a general sort of evenness. It's something which is a quality that can be used for producing a certain effect. You can use it almost like a tool. In fact, it goes on to the next word here, wieldy. Not only is it malleable, but it is wieldy. Now, this is an expression that you normally think of where you would use a weapon, maybe a sword, something that you can move and flash about, and you can direct, and you can actually use it as a tool in a very functional way. This is another description he uses for equanimity. And then the other one is radiant. So radiant here is referring to just the brilliance of the mind. Brilliance of equanimity here, in the sense that its ability to cognize. In other words, you're throwing light onto a situation, so you can see a situation very clearly. There's a lot of clarity. You know, it's that certainty, it's that confidence one has when one understands a situation very well, can see the situation, as opposed to someone in the dark who is not certain what's going on. But suddenly when the light's on, and suddenly you see the situation very clearly from, you know, because it's so brilliantly lit up, you have this confidence. Oh, it's simply that. I know how to maneuver. I know how to direct myself. I've got all the information here simply because it is seen so clearly. So this is the other quality, this radiance. Suppose, Bhikkhu, a skilled goldsmith or his apprentice were to prepare a furnace, heat it, heat up the crucible, take some gold with tongs and put it into the crucible. From time to time he would blow on it, from time to time he would sprinkle water over it, and from time to time he would just look on. That gold would become refined, well refined, completely refined, faultless, rid of dross, malleable, worldly, and radiant. Then whatever kind of ornament he wishes to make from it, whether a golden chain or earring or necklace or golden garland, it would serve his purpose. So too, Bhikkhu, then there remains only this equanimity, purified and bright, malleable, wieldy, and radiant. He understands thus, if I were to direct this equanimity, so purified and bright, to the base of infinite space, and to develop my mind accordingly, then this equanimity of mine, supported by that base, clinging to it, would remain for a very long time. So here, now, very suddenly, there's a whole new dimension that is being implied here. Suddenly, the Buddha is talking about the base of infinite space. Right now, this is a very, very deep meditation absorption. In fact, this is beyond the jhanas. This is actually into the formless realms, the formless absorptions. So what's actually being implied here is, see, the thing about these suttas is a bit of a problem when they're written down. They are designed when they were originally designed as teaching, as teaching instruments. So they were pared right down to their basic essentials. You're just given the bare bones, the skeleton, because
these suttas had to be remembered by chanting. You know, the Buddha, you know, thousands of suttas, and the monks had to remember this. So they had to be designed in such a way so they had just the bare information there, so that they could be remembered, picked up by the brain, and, you know, chanted. So a lot of background information is missing here, but the implication is here. Now, because the Buddha is now talking about a very, very deep state of meditation, we can take it for granted now that we can now get some idea of the setting of the situation. I have to go back now and look at the beginning of the sutta, and that is that the Buddha came into this potter's workshop. There's this monk there. It said that the Buddha then spent most of the night sitting in meditation. But it also said that Pukkasati also spent most of the night sitting in meditation. Right? And then the Buddha, who of course was conscious all this time, had plenty of time to suss out where Pukkasati is at. And at the end of this, the Buddha says, this monk, this bhikkhu, inspires confidence. Right? So the Buddha can see where he is, and now he gives him this teaching on the formless absorptions. So this would indicate then that the Buddha would have seen that during this time in the workshop, when this monk was sitting in meditation, he obviously had the facility to enter and dwell in the four jhanas. He must have been able to master the four jhanas for the Buddha to even broach anything like this sort of teaching. So we can take it for granted then that he is already a very, very capable, although he's only just recently gone forth, he's already a very capable contemplative. And I'll just read that bit again because it's significant. He understands that. This is the reference to the fact that equanimity, it means that this monk's mind, he can see that this bhikkhu's mind is now such that it's wieldy enough. See, when the equanimity is wieldy enough, it can then start venturing into things like the formless jhanas, these formless realms. So it's when the mind is capable, has to be very capable and wieldy to be able to enter and manage to manipulate itself in these high realms. So the Buddha can see that this bhikkhu has got that. So this is what the Buddha is now calling attention to, this aspect. He's asking this monk to look at this because he knows he's got it. So he's asking him to pay attention to it. He understands thus, if I were to direct this equanimity, so purified and bright, to the base of infinite space, and to develop my mind accordingly, then this equanimity of mine, supported by that base, clinging to it, would remain for a very long time. So what is actually meant there is that having used this equanimity to attain this base of infinite space, now actually getting fully absorbed into it, he would know, with that equanimity, the understanding, he would know what that base was. And basically, when the Buddha says he would remain for a very long time, it means that if he were just to stay there in that particular absorption, this particular absorption lasts for an incredibly long time. One could actually stay there. It's said in the descriptions of this space that I think it lasts for 20 aeons, 20 aeons of time. So that is absolutely beyond our possible calculation. In other words, the Buddha is saying that he knows, he understands that when he enters this realm, he knows what it is. He knows its vastness, its depth. That becomes apparent to him because with equanimity and this radiance of equanimity, you could say the identity, when you enter this realm, the identity with this realm and what it consists of becomes apparent to the consciousness. If I were to direct this equanimity, So purified and bright to the base of infinite consciousness, to the base of nothingness, to the base of neither perception nor non-perception, and to develop my mind accordingly, then this equanimity of mind, supported by that base, clinging to it, would remain for a very long time. So there, the Buddha has now, in the step process, gone through the other, even deeper formless absorptions, right down to the base of neither perception nor non-perception. Now, by now, he's getting into very, very deep water, because you're getting around sort of 80 aeons. Well, I can't remember whether it's 80 aeons or 80,000 aeons. I can't remember exactly what it is, but it's an extremely long time. Hang on, there's a note on that. There's 1276. Oh, no, hang on, I got it wrong. I got it. Space would reborn in the plane of infinite space and would live there for a full lifespan of 20,000 aeons. Well, there you have it. And then at the neither perception nor non-perception, that goes, they go up respectively about 20,000 aeons a time, so 40,000, 60,000, and then neither perception nor non-perception is 84,000 aeons. So in other words, this is giving you some indication of the level of contemplative attainment that this monk was at. He understands thus, if I were to direct this equanimity so purified and bright to the base of infinite space and to develop my mind accordingly, this would be conditioned. In other words, what he's saying, this would be conditioned, is that it's still the same process as this body. You know, it's still contact. These incredible absorption bases are still exactly the same system that we are involved in here and now. In other words, cause and effect. They are karma-based situations. So the Buddha says, he warns him here, he would know by this radiance that this space would still actually be conditioned, exactly the same as this situation here. But the problem is, he's now got 84,000 aeons to deal with. If he doesn't deal with it skillfully, in other words, if he gets trapped in that, if he gets trapped by the conditioning, he's worse off than if he's here. I mean, it's a pleasant enough place, these absorptions, but they're not places to get trapped in, because you get caught in the ignorance of them. And sooner or later they finish, they come to an end, and you're worse off than if you've never been in them. This would be conditioned. If I were to direct this equanimity, so purified and bright, to the base of infinite consciousness, to the base of nothingness, to the base of neither perception nor non-perception, and to develop my mind accordingly, this would be conditioned. He does not form any condition or generate any volition tending towards either being or non-being. Same thing here. There is an immense implication in just this statement here. It's not gone into in detail. It's just sort of, the Buddha, it's just in one sentence, he said, he's making a great, an incredible statement here. So we have to actually see what is actually being said here. He does not form any condition or generate any volition tending towards either being or non-being. In other words, through his equanimity and his radiance, the understanding that arises, if he's going... The Buddha is giving a condition that if he's doing the right process, if he's going the right way, he understands that if he generates any sort of volition, that is, volition that
I want. In other words, any sort of attachment, to either being or non-being, what we call sort of eternalism or nihilism, and that's basically the human condition, that the condition that you either want to live, you want to live forever, you just want to regenerate, you just don't want to die, or non-being, you want to annihilate, you want to get away from situations, they're too painful, they're too dreadful, you're running away from existence, and you're trying to annihilate the existence in some way. But that's not the way to get out of existence, trying to annihilate it. It's still an attachment to existence. That's not the way to do it. You have to let go. If you try to annihilate yourself, you're simply reborn as a being with annihilation consciousness. That is not the way out of existence. So in this very simple one sentence, this is what is being summed up. He does not form any condition or generate any volition tending towards either being or non-being. Since he does not form any condition or generate any volition tending towards either being or non-being, he does not cling to anything in this world. When he does not cling, he is not agitated. When he is not agitated, he personally attains nirvana. He understands thus, birth is destroyed. The holy life has been lived. What has to be done has been done. There is no more coming to any state of being. Now, this, you know, I just find this utterly incredible. Imagine the situation. This bhikkhu who just is in this potashed. He goes there for the night for a rest, and this monk comes in and says, "I'll offer you teaching." And he doesn't know him from Adam. just another monk. And he's coming out with all this incredible information. I mean, this Pukkasati must be thinking to himself, "My word, he's, you know, in stages." He must be thinking to himself, "My word, he's clever, this monk. Gee, he knows a lot." You know, and gradually you can imagine him saying, as this going on, he must be thinking to himself, "Wow, he really knows his stuff, this fellow." And then, because he makes a statement like, "And when he is not agitated, he personally attains nirvana." How does he know that? is he just trying to impress me? He's really coming out with some heavy stuff there. You know? So you know, you can just imagine, what must be going on in his mind. You know, sharing a room for the night with this fella. If he feels a pleasant feeling, he understands it is impermanent. There is no holding to it. There is no delight in it. If he feels a painful feeling, he understands it is impermanent. There is no holding to it. There is no delight in it. If he feels a neither painful nor pleasant feeling, he understands it is impermanent. There is no holding to it. There is no delight in it. If he feels a pleasant feeling, he feels it detached. If he feels a painful feeling, he feels it detached. No, painful feelings don't bother him. If he feels neither painful nor pleasant feeling, he feels it detached. When he feels a feeling terminating with the body, he understands, "I feel a feeling terminating with the body." When he feels a feeling terminating with life, he understands, "I feel a feeling terminating with life." Now, who would make a statement like that? You're talking about someone who is experiencing, you know, the death process, and right there he's not attached. You know, I'm feeling a feeling that is going to result in death. Fine, you know, that's it. You know, this is actually what this monk is saying. He understands, on the dissolution of the body with the ending of life, all that is felt, not being delighted in, will become cool right here. So what that means is, now you'd normally think, when the body dies,
So what does that mean to the body? You know, if you're an annihilationist, when the body dies, you think, well, it's going to become cool right here anyway. That's the end. You're dead. So what could he possibly mean? What can he possibly mean? It becomes cool right here when it's so obvious that it becomes cool right here. That can't be what he means. He's implying something else. And of course, what he's implying is that it's the whole process, the whole samsaric process of karma, which has frizzled out, has cooled down and is no longer existent. It's not just that he has now relinquished the body. He has relinquished literally the whole of existence. There cannot be any more coming to be. There cannot be any more life after this. He's totally free of the whole system of suffering and the problems of existence. Okay. He understands on the dissolution of the body with the ending of life, all that is felt, not being delighted in, will become cool right here. Bhikkhu, just as an oil lamp burns in dependence on oil and wick, and when the oil and wick are used up, if it does not get any more fuel, it is extinguished from lack of fuel. So too, when he feels a feeling terminating with the body, a feeling terminating with life, he understands. I feel a feeling terminating with life. He understands. On the dissolution of the body with the ending of life, all that is felt, not being delighted in, will become cool right here. Therefore, a bhikkhu possesses this wisdom, possesses the supreme foundation of wisdom. Isn't that an incredible thing to say? You know, these statements are just overwhelming. Therefore, a bhikkhu possesses this wisdom, possesses the supreme foundation of wisdom. For this bhikkhu is the supreme noble wisdom, namely the knowledge of the destruction of all suffering. Now, there you have it. You know, that's what the Buddha teaches. His deliverance, being founded upon truth, is unshakable. Wow, isn't that something? You know, in other words, this wisdom that he has, or this confidence he has, is not a faith-based thing. It's not a belief. There's no sort of belief system involved. He's not expecting his faith to save him. He knows absolutely for certain, and this is the expression, his deliverance being founded upon truth is unshakable. For that is false, bhikkhu, which has a deceptive nature, and that is true, which has an undeceptive nature, nibbana. Therefore, a bhikkhu possessing this truth possesses the supreme foundation of truth. For this bhikkhu is the supreme noble truth, namely nibbana, which has an undeceptive nature. Formerly, when he was ignorant, he acquired and developed attachments. Now he has abandoned them, cut them off at the root, made them like a palm tree stump, done away with them so that they are no longer subject to future arising. Therefore, a bhikkhu possessing this relinquishment possesses the supreme foundation of relinquishment. For this bhikkhu's is the supreme foundation. For this bhikkhu's is the supreme noble relinquishment, namely the relinquishing of all attachments. Formerly, when he was ignorant, he experienced covetousness, desire, and lust. Now he has abandoned them, cut them off at the root, made them like a palm tree stump, done away with them so that they are no longer subject to future arising. Formerly, when he was ignorant, he experienced anger, ill will, hate. Now he has abandoned them, cut them off at the root, made them like a palm tree stump, done away with them so that they are no longer subject to future arising. Formerly, when he was ignorant, he experienced ignorance and delusion. Now he has abandoned them, cut them off at the root, made them like a palm tree stump, done away with them so that they are no longer subject to future arising. Therefore, a bhikkhu possessing this peace possesses the supreme foundation of peace. For this bhikkhu is the supreme noble peace, namely the pacification of lust, hate, and delusion.
greed, hatred, and delusion are completely eradicated from him. So it is with reference to this that it was said, one should not neglect wisdom, should preserve truth, should cultivate relinquishment, and should train for peace. The tides of conceiving do not sweep over one who stands upon these foundations. And when the tides of conceiving no longer sweep over him, he is called a sage at peace. So it was said, and with reference to what was that said? Bhikkhu, I am is a conceiving. I am this is a conceiving. I shall be is a conceiving. I shall not be is a conceiving. I shall be possessed of form is a conceiving. I shall be formless is a conceiving. I shall be percipient is a conceiving. I shall be non-percipient is a conceiving. I shall be neither percipient nor non-percipient is a conceiving. So in other words, this whole reference that the Buddha is giving here is basically the thinking process in all the realms of samsara, that this world and all the other realms that it's possible to go in, all the heavenly realms, all the deep meditation, jhanic absorptions, as long as there is this idea of that it is me in this process, that I am the person experiencing this world, I'm the person experiencing the jhanas, I'm the person now experiencing the absorptions, the formless absorptions, as long as there's still that idea that it's me and not this impersonal process of impermanence, this impermanent flow, at any point that you actually think this process that is being involved, that you identify as me in this process, you are conceiving. And that conceiving in itself is attachment to me, I am. That idea, I am, is what is holding you in existence. You are here because you believe you are here. You believe in yourself. You believe you are a person. You believe you exist. And just that belief is the attachment which holds you into existence. And what does the Buddha think of that? Right, now he lets you know. I shall be neither percipient nor non-percipient is a conceiving. Conceiving is a disease. Conceiving is a tumor. Conceiving is a dart. By overcoming all conceivings, bhikkhu, one is called a sage at peace. And the sage at peace is not born, does not age, does not die. He is not shaken, he is not agitated. And there is nothing present in him by which he might be born. Isn't that an amazing thing to say? There's nothing in him by which he might be born. Not being born, how could he age? Not aging, how could he die? Not dying, how could he be shaken? Not being shaken, how could he be agitated? So it was with reference to this that it was said, the tides of conceiving do not sweep over. The tides of conceiving do not sweep over one who stands upon these foundations. And when the tides of conceiving no longer sweep over him, he is called a sage at peace. Bhikkhu, bear in mind this brief exposition of the six elements. So at this point, this bhikkhu, Pukkasati, he's just blown away by this, and it's just so overwhelmingly obvious to him. This is the most incredible thing. This is no ordinary monk. This is no ordinary bhikkhu. This can only be the Buddha, you know, right here and now. It's just amazing. You know? So now the penny drops. Thereupon the venerable Pukkasati thought, indeed, the teacher has come to me. The sublime one has come to me. The fully enlightened one has come to me. Then he rose from his seat, arranged his upper robe over one shoulder, and prostrating himself with his head at the Blessed One's feet, he said, venerable sir, a transgression came over me. In that like a fool, confusing, blundering,
I presume to address the Blessed One as friend. Venerable Sir, may the Blessed One forgive me for my transgression, seen as such for the sake of restraint in the future. Surely, Bhikkhu, a transgression came over you. In that, like a fool, confused and blundering, you presume to address me as friend. But since you see your transgression as such and make amends in accordance with the Dharma, we forgive you. For it is growth in the Noble One's discipline. When one sees one's transgression as such, makes amends in accordance with the Dharma, and undertakes restraint in future. Venerable Sir, I would receive the full admission under the Blessed One. But are your bowl and robes complete, Bhikkhu? Venerable Sir, my bowl and robes are not complete. Bhikkhu, Tathagatas do not give full admission to anyone whose bowls and robes are not complete. Then the Venerable Pukkasati, having delighted and rejoiced in the Blessed One's words, rose from his seat, and after paying homage to the Blessed One, keeping him on his right, he departed in order to search for bowl and robes. Then here again, there's the briefness of these expositions. It can be quite comical at times. In one sentence, poor old Pukkasati is eliminated. Then, while the Venerable Pukkasati was searching for bowl and robes, a stray cow killed him. But he must have spoken to other bhikkhus previously, or the Buddha must have spoken to other bhikkhus about Pukkasati, because then it goes on. Then a number of bhikkhus went to the Blessed One, and after paying homage to him, they sat down to one side and told him, Venerable Sir, the clansman Pukkasati, who was given brief instruction by the Blessed One, has died. What is his destination? What is his future course? Bhikkhus, the clansman Pukkasati was wise. He practiced in accordance with the Dharma and did not trouble me in the interpretation of the Dharma. With the destruction of the five lower fetters, the clansman Pukkasati has reappeared spontaneously in the pure abodes and will attain final Nibbana there without ever returning from that world. That is what the Blessed One said. The bhikkhus were satisfied and delighted in the Blessed One's words. There we have the sutta. Sorry? Oh, see, that's the point I mentioned at the end. Either Pukkasati, when he left the Buddha, may have met other monks and talked with them, or either the Buddha would have spoken to other monks, because the Buddha often did that. The Buddha often would explain if he had a meeting or he gave a teaching to someone, he would say, "Oh, recently." I gave a teaching on so-and-so. So the monks must have been familiar with this situation, and probably the Buddha may have said to Pukkasati, see, because it's very brief, you know, the Buddha would have given him instruction on how he could go to other bhikkhus and get these requisites he needed to ordain. And so by means of that, you know, there would have been more communication. The fact that this was recorded, it meant that someone somewhere had related this story. Buddha did have a shaved head, yes. The Buddha was absolutely identical to another bhikkhu, except that his robe was worn longer than the other bhikkhus. This was done deliberately so that the Buddha could always be recognized if he was walking in a group with other bhikkhus, that he could be recognized by his longer robe. And in fact, it's one of the Vinaya rules for monks is that they are not allowed to have a robe the same length as the Buddha, because there was one monk that actually was a tall monk and he had a robe the same length as the Buddha. and people mistook him for the Buddha, and treated him as the Buddha, and then this caused confusion. So the Buddha made this rule that in future, to avoid confusion, monks should keep their robes at a certain length, and the Buddha deliberately wore his robe longer so that he could always be recognized. These are just stylizations. If you look at all the Buddha statues from all the different cultures and periods, that you can tell what Buddha rupa, what Buddha statue comes from, what period, what culture, because they've all got their own particular stylizations. But the Buddha shaved his head. He was referred to as a shaveling by other sects. The Buddha shaved his head and he looked exactly the same as this head here. Well, I can't say that. Not exactly the same. Got to be careful here. But the Buddha shaved his head just the same as all the other monks. And it's just subsequent stylizations that give the Buddha hair. And they do this for various reasons. Like, one of the signs of the Buddha is that the hair on his body was said to grow in whorls. When it grew, it didn't grow straight, it grew in little circles. So to depict this, there was no way that you could actually depict this as one of the marks of the Buddha. So they actually used the hair of the head as gigantic ringlets. They actually put hair on the Buddha's head. So you'd see these curls on the Buddha's head. These ringlets indicate that the hair on the Buddha's head, on his body generally, grew in these whorls. So it indicates this is a mark of the Buddha. But of course, the hair has been exaggerated there. But in fact, in the discipline, the hair is allowed to grow to a length of, I think it's two finger breadths, like this. So quite possibly the Buddha may well have had hair that long. I'm not sure whether it would have actually grown in ringlets like that. It's quite comical. I think in the earlier traditions, in some tradition, I think it was in China, they got the impression when they saw the Buddha with all these ringlets on his head, they thought they were snails. And he said, so then it got into the teaching and in their depictions that the Buddha had snails on his head. Any questions? Okay, fine. We'll call the session to an end.